Chapter 5. It's like being on eBay with 50 other states. From his home in the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., Rear Admiral John Poluchek was popping back and forth from his study to an adjacent kitchen, firing off work emails and tending to a pot of onion soup, when his cell phone buzzed and upended his life. The screen said it was Lieutenant General Glenn D. Van Herk, which was most unusual for a Sunday evening. Van Herk reported to U.S. Army General Mark A. Milley, the president's top military advisor and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Hey, Director, Poluchek answered with some hesitation. How are you today? What can I do for you? It was near 5 p.m. on March 15, 2020. The same day the CDC warned against gatherings of more than 50 people, just 2 days after President Donald Trump had declared a national state of emergency, 4 days after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic, and many weeks after this call should have come. Health and Human Services has asked for some logistics planning help, Van Herk said. Poluchek took that to mean that HHS Secretary Azar, or Asper Cadleck, had reached out for help from the Defense Department.
Yeah, okay,
Poluchek said. As the Pentagon's top supply chain and logistics expert, he'd spent decades overseeing multi-billion-dollar acquisitions of Tomahawk missiles and guided missile destroyers, and the countless bits and pieces that comprise them, and hail from different sources and manufacturers across the globe. He understood the intricate complexity of a globalized world and the delicate supply chains that live behind just about every product, commercial, military, or otherwise. But that week, he had switched gears to piece together part of the Defense Department's pandemic response, which at this point was in its infancy. As for the larger response taken on by the Trump administration, the 33-year Navy officer wasn't yet plugged in, though he'd witnessed the same televised chaos as every other American. They just need some help planning, Van Herk explained. And I got the green light from the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to take a few people and go over to Health and Human Services and see what we can do to help. For how long? Poluchek asked. We don't know. John, just go. The general continued. I just need you to go over there Monday. Take some people. Go see what they need and see if you can help them with logistics and supply chain planning for the pandemic. Poluchek alerted other relevant Pentagon officials to prepare for a trip to HHS the next day and returned to his simmering onion soup, which he shared with his wife, Karen. They would not see much of each other in the coming months. Just hours later, on the morning of March 16th, Trump held a conference call with a group of state governors. According to a recording that leaked to the media, the president told governors, respirators, ventilators, all of the equipment, try getting it yourselves. As instructed, Poluchek reached out to HHS that Monday, but no one seemed to be expecting him. He called Dr. Christian Hassel, Cadleck's deputy at Asper, who said he hadn't been told to expect anyone and needed to hear it directly from leadership before he could invite a bunch of DOD folks over. It was the first sign, Poluchek would learn, that officials at HHS were terrified to do anything without direct approval from a Trump political appointee, who were themselves terrified to do anything that might place them in a snarling presidential tweet. Finally, he told Hassel he was absolutely coming over. At about 2 p.m. on March 16th, Poluchek and a small entourage arrived at HHS headquarters, inside the Hubert H. Humphrey building at the foot of Capitol Hill. That was Monday, Poluchek would later tell me. A very non-fulfilling day, but I will tell you, my first impression on that Monday? No one at Health and Human Services was walking around with a sense of urgency. I could not ascertain a sense of direction. The next day, the DOD entourage returned and set up shop in offices near officials working under Asper. There was no one at HHS who had a background in supply chain logistics, let alone a team of people. The stockpile had, for most of its history, been housed under the CDC, based in Atlanta. So the agency largely responsible for disaster response, FEMA, was at best an arm's length away from the supply it would need for said response. For these reasons and others, Polovchek would come to believe that, whatever the executive leadership, HHS was fundamentally and structurally ill-equipped for the occasion. Perhaps most shocking to Polovchek, the nation's stockpile, its first line of defense against a biological attack or a pandemic, was being managed by way of Microsoft Excel spreadsheets and a whiteboard. Details confirmed to me by two other sources familiar with the stockpile in the Trump and Obama administrations. In fact, the method of tracking had not advanced since 2009, when Obama officials themselves were using simple spreadsheets on the fly to track inventory in response to the H1N1 swine flu. "You have got to be kidding me," Polovchek thought. Employees at about a dozen warehouses, tucked in secrecy around the country, kept tabs on their own inventories by manually updating disparate tables with varying formats, none of which gave officials in Washington a reliable or national view of what was on hand. In other words, every drugstore, supermarket, and retail chain in America had a better grasp on its inventory than the most powerful country in the world did of its own emergency supplies. Not that it mattered. I walked in, and the national stockpile had been given out, Polovchek says. I didn't have a single N95 mask, surgical mask, isolation gown, nitrile glove. It had been issued. This was news not just to Polovchek, but also to the many states that were still requesting materials. That very day, emails show, the commissioner of Texas's Department of State Health Services wrote to ASPR and HHS officials that his state needed a large cache of respirators and other equipment. The agency had surveyed hospitals and found that hospital buyers were being told by manufacturers, including 3M and Cardinal Health, to expect back orders and delays as far out as fall 2020, maybe longer. Polovchek conveyed his concerns to Cadleck and other HHS officials. By Wednesday, Cadleck called him to his office and informed him of higher-level conversations about creating a special team to handle supplies. The effort would be lifted and shifted to FEMA, under the purview of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, not HHS. And the administration wanted Polovchek to run it. Polovchek had worked with FEMA during Hurricanes Sandy and Maria, deploying Navy resources where they were needed. In this role, he'd come to know chapter and verse what experts call the Emergency Response Framework. The framework is a detailed yet simple set of organizing guidelines that were developed over decades to help any administration work through any disaster. To be reductive, the response is tiered in this way. Execution falls to the lowest possible jurisdictions, meaning local fire and police departments are typically the front line. The state manages a broader strategy with emergency declarations, funding or routing state resources to hotspots, for instance. And the federal government wields its vast reach and resources to back everyone up, often based on what the lower jurisdictions say they need. The idea is that with this rubric, the response won't be made up on the fly, since that can lead to devastating failures, jurisdictional conflict, and oversights. But unlike a localized crisis such as a hurricane, the COVID-19 pandemic presented challenges that had only been imagined in government drills or science fiction, a threat to all 50 states at the same time, and a crisis in which all of them needed supplies that were either gone or running out. Polovchek was planning to retire in June, but told Cadleck he would step in. And with DOD approval, he was put on loan from the Pentagon to FEMA. The next day, Thursday, Polovchek met with HHS Secretary Azar's chief of staff, Paul Mango, a fellow military man who'd graduated from West Point and obtained a master's degree from Harvard Business School. He'd also run unsuccessfully for governor of Pennsylvania before joining the Trump administration. Mango explained that the country was almost entirely dependent on products coming in from Asia, which was locking down. "Man, we are in a lot of trouble," Polovchek told Mango. The two began to map out a supply chain task force and discussed who should be plucked from where to lead a global hunt and buying spree. To do so, they needed to go to the White House and talk strategy with Pence, the chairman of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. That Friday, March 20th, Polovchek reported to Pence's office at the White House. Before Pence arrived, Polovchek was greeted first by Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. Kushner had inserted himself and begun dispensing free market principles into a complicated situation, for which many emergency experts thought the government should wield a very visible hand. Critics wanted to know why the administration hadn't executed on the Defense Production Act earlier to compel American companies to produce or ramp up production of ventilators and PPE, and give the U.S. government first dibs on their purchase. Instead, in conjunction with Pence's official task force, Kushner was cobbling together what would later be known as his own shadow task force. It was composed of a small network of well-to-do friends, private industry consultants, contacts he had made in business, and other volunteers. Their task: to infuse the ingenuity and hustle of free market capitalism into the response by working the phones and email to quickly find supplies, buy them, and deliver them where needed, all outside of government red tape. Polovchek would come to call this dialing for dollars. As the two waited for Pence, Kushner explained his plan. "Oh, God, really?" Polovchek said. Kushner was taken aback. Okay, the admiral said. "Well, you're not going to do that out of the White House." Pence arrived, and so began the meeting with the admiral, Kushner, Mango, and a few strap hangers to design a plan to protect the American people. Kushner and the vice president described a fanciful list of wishes that had no obvious strategy or tactics behind them. They needed to get PPE to here, to there, from there, to here, with the help of this guy and maybe that company. They were not afraid to go around normal contracting channels. This was, after all, the Trump administration. "I just sat there and listened," Polovchek remembers. "I don't remember all of the, words." Finally, Polovchek interjected. "Look, that's a lot of unfocused effort." The two gazed at the admiral for a moment. "How are you going to do transportation?" Polovchek asked. "How are you going to get it here? How are you going to buy it? How are you going to keep track of the money, do the contracting?" As the former governor and top executive of the state of Indiana, Pence knew well the mechanics of government purchasing. In normal times, there's a rigorous bidding process to ensure fairness and weed out fraud and firms that can't do the job. It can take many months. There are binding contracts, lawyers on either side, considerations for minority-owned businesses, background checks. In the federal government, contractors are typically pre-vetted before they are eligible to engage in the process at all. The money is accounted for by comptrollers and made public in government purchasing data. Audits are conducted. In an emergency, some of this is thrown out the window to speed up acquisition, and purchasing officers might take a stance of awarding work first and asking questions later. But the process isn't completely demolished. Though the process might have seemed onerous in the context of a global pandemic, there remained numerous practical considerations, such as how might a volunteer consultant tap into government coffers to buy a lot of masks? How does a non-government employee approve a contract? How does the United States verify that the product is legitimate? Who is going to transport it? Yeah. How are we going to do all of this? Polovchuk remembers Pence asking. A core principle of the response framework had already been violated. A codified chain of command involving emergency response experts should be placed in charge of logistics, not politicians. The doctrine also guides that any response needs to be scalable, flexible, and adaptable, so as to be executed nationally for any type of crisis to assist thousands of disparate local governments and agencies, and to coordinate with nonprofits and the private sector. It is not done from the personal cell phone of the president's son-in-law. With reality sinking in, Polovchuk provided some inchoate goals that he would refine and call his four lines of effort, which drew from the emergency response framework. They were 1. Preservation. We needed to ration masks and compel healthcare workers to reuse as much as possible. 2. Acceleration. We needed to hasten the acquisition and delivery of PPE to the U.S. 3. Expansion. We needed to increase manufacturing through private makers, with either the threat of or invocation of the Defense Production Act. 4. Allocation. We needed to move PPE to where it was most needed. The meeting lasted about a half hour. Polovchuk gave Pence a written brief on what he'd like to do under the FEMA flag. Over the weekend, Polovchuk says, Pence marked it up, added some edits, and asked staffers to rework it into the White House's brief format. The admiral was surprised to learn that he'd be standing up at the White House podium on Monday, March 23rd, to announce a new supply chain stabilization task force to the American people. That Monday, Trump spoke first, in his usual broken coherence. Then came Attorney General Bill Barr and Dr. Deborah Birx, the physician who was then directing the White House response. Finally, Pence spoke and introduced the admiral. Acceleration, Polovchuk explained, easing into his presentation after some initial hesitation. We have a team of people that are searching the globe for personal protective equipment, figuring out where it is, figuring out if we need to buy it or just transport it and get it here faster. To his right, Trump looked on with pursed lips in that gravity-defying, forward-leaning stance of his. There are many vendors, many distributors, all on separate systems, Polovchuk continued. Nobody has one-sight picture for that supply chain. Polovchuk, who had grown up on submarines and spent his career in the dark recesses of the military-industrial complex, far from the news media's gaze, had just become the face of the nation's supply crisis. The next week, inside FEMA, Polovchuk noticed a few fresh-faced strangers mulling around, out of their element. Polovchuk thought they were interns, but no. They were civilians, inserted into the heart of the national response, armed with only can-do attitudes, personal wealth, and a laptop. Despite Polovchuk's initial skepticism, Kushner moved ahead with his shadow task force, recruiting a couple dozen volunteers. Most of them were in their 20s and had taken either vacation or leave from high-paying jobs at Google or consulting firms like McKinsey and Insight, while others hailed from Goldman Sachs and private equity firms. Their stint was short, a few weeks. But their fumbling and the chaos created by their presence would make for great media fodder. It would also result in a whistleblower complaint to Congress by a young member of the Kennedy family who had volunteered and become alarmed by what he had witnessed. They were very young, Polovchuk says. It was finally FEMA that figured out that they were non-governmental employees and then made them all sign, you know, non-disclosure agreements. And some said they couldn't and left. When he realized the Kushner kids, as he called them, were volunteer civilians, Polovchuk says he relegated them to perform his team's least enviable task, sifting through thousands of leads of potential PPE stock, the vast majority of them garbage, that were streaming into the task force from multiple directions, including the patronage-prone White House. Once we figured out, we being the adult leadership at FEMA, that these were non-government folks, we made them all go away, Polovchek says, referring to mission-critical tasks. For all its amateurish execution, Kushner's task force would in many ways overshadow the larger effort Polovchek had undertaken to source supplies, which involved government officials working with manufacturers such as 3M, Cardinal Health, and Honeywell, under the threat of the Defense Production Act. As the kids dialed for dollars, Polovchek says he and FEMA officials were scrambling to build what he'd call the control tower, a computer dashboard that streamed in inventory, purchasing, and other data from legitimate PPE manufacturers and distributors. This information, paired with a view of where cases were spreading in U.S. cities, finally began to give the admiral and his team some visibility. It was imperfect and messy, but it was something. To prop this up, the admiral and his team ran for weeks on just a few hours of sleep each night. They practically lived at FEMA, so much so that his wife Karen unofficially adopted Polovchek's young assistant, helping with his laundry and groceries. She brought food for the team so they could stick to their desks as the world was falling apart. If nothing else, Polovchek says, the Kushner kids served a purpose in saving the adults from getting bogged down with bullshit leads. Between myself and the FEMA administrator, I probably had 1,000 emails from people a day, the admiral recalls. But the truth was the federal government was desperate, so how could he ignore the tips? I had people run down every one of those leads, Polovchek says. So some of these volunteers helped with that. Somebody had to go do it. I did not want to pass a stone not overturned. I empathize with this particular point. Over a year and a half of reporting for ProPublica and for this book, I too ventured down the rabbit holes, chasing dozens of leads that went nowhere, getting lost in emails between desperate government workers and would-be vendors and Nimrod scammers. With the help of ProPublica researchers and a separate researcher I hired to help with this book, I reviewed thousands of purchasing and email records obtained via open records laws, from New York City to New Orleans, Houston, Austin, California, and more. It was an unmitigated bullshit bonanza, a nightmare for anyone receiving tips for PPE during the spring and summer of 2020. I wouldn't wish it on anyone, except maybe the Kushner kids. But therein lies the true scandal. While it's true that the Kushner kids gave some cover for the admiral and freed up FEMA and military personnel to do other work, their mere existence speaks to the country's lack of preparation and the compounding tragedy of having this particular administration in control. None of it had to happen. Polovchek's great fear in those harried weeks in March and April was that his team would miss an opportunity and someone would tell the newspapers, "Hey, I had masks that the federal government didn't buy." We had thousands of leads. Now, 95% of those were just somebody that said, "I have access to something." But they didn't have it on hand. It wasn't in a warehouse. In May, Polovchek's fear was realized. The Kushner kids had sat on a promising lead from a South Carolina doctor, who in turn had a lead on millions of masks from a Chinese factory. The lead went nowhere, and the doctor later told the media he sold the masks to hospitals. As leads like that languished, the Kushner kids had placed high priority on dead-end leads streaming in from Trump allies and prominent Republicans, going so far as to track those tips on a spreadsheet called VIP Update. On Friday, March 27th, the New York Times front page carried the headline, "Job Losses Soar, U.S. Virus Cases Top World." With increased testing came the data that proved the immensity of our failure. More than 80,000 confirmed cases and 1,000 deaths, worse than China, Italy, or any other country. As bad as that data was, the newspaper published an alarming bar chart that was perhaps even more politically damaging to Trump. It was a rolling bar chart of the number of unemployment claims over time, which sat at the bottom of page one, but for the singular bar representing the most recent data. That bar burst past its predecessors and ascended the page, above the fold and just below the bold headline, revealing a record 3.3 million unemployment claims in 1 week. An unprecedented spike in jobless claims during an election year is an incumbent's worst nightmare. Later that day, Trump posted a shame tweet at Ford and General Motors, urging them to start making ventilators now. Among the thousands of replies, a Silicon Valley engineer named Yaron Oren Pines responded, "We can supply ICU ventilators, invasive and non-invasive. Have someone call me. Urgent." There was nothing to indicate that this guy could deliver. He had 75 followers on Twitter and no experience in medical supplies or government procurement. Nonetheless, his lead was given priority status, and the Kushner kids forwarded it to emergency managers in New York, who assumed the federal government had done due diligence. The state quickly awarded the man an $86 million contract for 1,450 ventilators, an extreme markup of 3 to 4 times the usual cost of a ventilator. Yet more astonishing, that deal paid out $69 million in advance. No ventilators were ever delivered by Oren Pines, and the state would later fight in court to claw back its payment. Although Kushner's involvement in the enterprise captured loads of negative media attention, and at the very least created unneeded distractions, Polovchek was grateful for his presence. Mr. Kushner did nothing more than break down bureaucratic barriers and provide avenues for me to get shit done, the admiral insisted to me. And I never, ever had to go ask permission from Mr. Kushner to do anything, the admiral said. I went to him to say, I need more resources. Go find me more money. Go bring me a lot more lawyers. I need the White House counsel to do X. And he got it done. Still, it is undeniable that Kushner's involvement alienated would-be partners, such as blue state governors, and cast a shadow over the larger effort. This was especially true with the execution of Project AirBridge. The basic concept of Project AirBridge was this. Instead of waiting on traditional and time-consuming imports by sea, the United States could fly smaller international shipments of PPE directly to where they were needed. Supplies like N95 masks typically arrive at U.S. ports by way of maritime shipping containers, which take about a month to arrive from factories and ports in Asia. Those avenues were shutting down as China nationalized its own supply sources. What supplies could make it out took far too long to reach U.S. soil by sea. And once they arrived at any number of coastal ports, the supplies would need to be handed over to FEMA, which would then have to handle further transport to areas in need. Lives were at stake. So FEMA envisioned a much faster and much more expensive solution, paying companies like FedEx and UPS to pick up supplies and fly them to where the control tower said they were needed. Contrary to what some envisioned, the federal government would not be constructing giant PPE factories, taking over 3M, or standing up behemoth warehouses as a nationalized effort. Polovchek viewed his role as more of an air traffic controller, whose job was to organize what existed, get more of it, and send it on its way. Also contrary to what was reported or inferred during those whirlwind days, Polovchek says Project AirBridge was his brainchild, not Kushner's, and that it was informed by conversations he had with supply chain experts at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and elsewhere. Yet, Kushner was made the face of the program when it was announced on March 29th, as the project's first commercial carrier landed at New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport with shipments of gloves, gowns, and masks destined for COVID hotspots in the Northeast. In a statement released that day, Kushner billed it as a groundbreaking public-private partnership between the White House and American medical equipment distributors, such as Cardinal, McKesson, Owens & Minor, Medline, and Henry Schein, Inc. At President Trump's direction, we formed an unprecedented public-private partnership to ensure that massive amounts of masks, gear, and other PPE will be brought to the United States immediately to better equip our healthcare workers on the front lines and to better serve the American people, Kushner said in a statement. This gave the impression to the public that Trump and Kushner were directing the effort and diverting supplies where they saw fit. And it coalesced with complaints and some anecdotal evidence that states with governors loyal to Trump were being favored over blue states, and that FEMA was commandeering and rerouting shipments ordered by other government agencies. Polovchek maintains he was the one calling the shots, and that the rest was political theater. Mr. Kushner had nothing to do with Airbridge, Polovchek says. I did not run it past him. I voiced it. I told him. I said at a task force meeting, we are going to create an Airbridge. I am reconfiguring the commercial marketplace from maritime mode of transport to air. And everybody said, holy crap, that makes sense, the admiral claims. We're going to fly it. We're going to pay for it. And there were some other stipulations. But Kushner had nothing to do with Airbridge. I don't care what anybody said. It's not how it went down. He had nothing to do with Airbridge. The program would be beset with allegations of secrecy and investigative reports detailing gross exaggerations. But the bottom line was this. Polovchek and Kushner did manage to accelerate a not meaningless amount of PPE to some U.S. hospitals, even if it was just a drop in the bucket. Still, the lack of a real national strategy led to just the sort of confusion, unnecessary competition, and price gouging that had been predicted. States facing an onslaught of patients, overrun hospitals, and supply shortages began to speak out and dispel the Trump administration's lie that the nation was ready and well-stocked. Leading the frustrated chorus was New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo, who had stood up daily televised briefings on the state's coronavirus response. In just days, New York had become the epicenter of the outbreak, with more than 1,500 people dead. By the morning of March 31st, Cuomo sat down at a dais, frustrated, two aides at either side, distanced, indignant and wringing his hands. Cuomo told reporters and a growing national viewership, you now literally will have a company call you up and say, well, California just outbid you. It's like being on eBay with 50 other states bidding on a ventilator, and you see the bid go up because California bid, Illinois bid, Florida bid, New York bids, California rebids. That's literally what we're doing. I mean, how inefficient. Other governors began to speak up, including Maryland's Republican governor, Larry Hogan, who said his state was flying blind because despite what Trump officials said, there just weren't enough test kits to trace the virus's spread there. Polovchek was now in the crosshairs. He was the adult herding Kushner and his kids, a decorated military man who'd lost control of a political message, a logistician in a world throwing away logic. I cannot overstate how stupid the politics were, Polovchek told me, on both sides, Democrat and Republican. Accustomed to working in the context of confidential military operations, he was at first comfortable letting Kushner hog the limelight, though in time he'd come to wish he had been trained or had thought more about how smart public relations might have helped the story of his role in our national nightmare. Despite his efforts, Polovchek began to realize he might go down in the public's perception as something of a villain. a cog in the Kushner-Trump-Pence bungling of the pandemic. Finally, what tenuous hold he had on the message was eviscerated on April 2nd, when Kushner, riled by the comments of governors including Cuomo, addressed the media for a task force update. The notion of the federal stockpile was, it's supposed to be our stockpile, Kushner said. It's not supposed to be the state's stockpile that they then use. It was a flagrant and verifiable lie. The entire mission of the national stockpile was to provide supplies to states, or, as the HHS website put it, to supplement state and local supplies during public health emergencies. To conform to Kushner's televised reimagining of an entire federal government program, those words were deleted from the website shortly after the briefing and supplanted with new language that better matched Kushner's mental leap. Kushner went on to say that the pandemic was revealing that some state leaders are better managers than others. Some governors you speak to, or senators, and they don't know what's in their state, the man continued. Don't ask us for things when you don't know what you have in your own state. For no justifiable reason, medical supplies had become a political issue, and public faith in the Trump administration's effort to supply and protect America's healthcare workers was irretrievably diminished. Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, a Democrat, said simply, "We are on our own." And they were.